Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. Nadine Burke Harris is a passionate advocate for children's health with four boys of her own. She is the founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point. She is the subject of a New Yorker profile and the recipient of a Heinz Award. Her TED Talk, How Childhood Trauma Affects Health Across the Lifetime, has been viewed over 3 million times. Dr. Burke Harris's new book is The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. Follow her at Dr. Burke Harris. Dr. Burke Harris, what exactly is adverse childhood experience?
The term adverse childhood experiences comes from this groundbreaking research that was done by the CDC and Kaiser Permanente that was published in 1998. In that research study, what they did was they asked 17,500 adults about their histories of stressful or traumatic experiences in childhood. Those included physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, physical and emotional neglect, or growing up in a household where a parent was mentally ill, substance dependent, incarcerated, where there was parental separation or divorce, or domestic violence. What they found was that in addition to the fact that these experiences were incredibly common, two-thirds of the folks in the study had experienced at least one, and one in eight folks had experienced four or more, that there was a strong and direct link between childhood adversity and health outcomes. So the higher the number of adverse childhood experiences a person had, the greater their risk for things like heart disease, cancer, stroke, chronic lung disease. That research has really been a game changer for understanding how early adversity affects our health.
In your book, you write about the fact that some folks seem to overcome it and others don't. But even the folks that overcome it, they're still carrying around these risk factors. Why is that?
Yeah, in our society, we like to believe that there are some folks who overcome or who pull themselves up by their bootstraps because they may not show any mental health or behavioral symptomatology, right? So if you didn't end up being an alcoholic or, high school dropout, then you've overcome. But what the research shows is that for anyone who is exposed to high doses of adversity in childhood, they have significantly higher risk of things like heart disease and cancer. The research now tells us why that happens. Initially, we thought it was because those folks had bad behavior, right? Like they drank and smoked and did all this health damaging behavior. That's partly true, but it's not entirely true. Risk behavior only accounts for about half of the increased risk of these health problems. But the other half simply has to do with how our bodies biologically respond to the experiences of adversity.
Well, you give an analogy. You talk about tadpoles and what happens with them, how if there's stress going on in the pond and maybe there's too many tadpoles trying to get food, if the adversity happens at a certain point in a tadpole's development, it doesn't matter as much. But if it happens too early, that can be really bad.
Yeah.
Is there a similar biological imperative with us? I think about those tadpoles and the point that the adversity happens. When the tadpoles that are too young don't mature, is it nature's way to sort of thin the herd? And so I wonder, how does that apply to people?
Yeah, so the work with tadpoles was actually research that I did when I was in college at UC Berkeley and first started to learn about the stress response and stress hormones and how they affect growth and development. Yeah, what they found was like, even in tadpoles, when they're really stressed out, if that stress happens later in their lives, right, that it can be more adaptive. But if it happens too early, they're exceedingly vulnerable. And in tadpoles, it can lead to death. This happens across species. And in humans, what we find is that children are especially vulnerable to the effects of high doses of adversity because their brains and bodies are just developing. What we see is changes in the structure and function of children's developing brains, their hormonal levels, their immune system and inflammation in their body, and even changes to the way their DNA is read and transcribed.
Wow, that's huge.
It is really profound. I think when a lot of people hear this, there's a potential for it almost to feel scary.
Yeah.
But for me, it's the opposite. For me, it's profoundly hopeful because this process has been going on for a really long time and we didn't understand why.
Mm.
And what the science is giving us now is the opportunity to understand the mechanism, to biologically understand how this happens so that we can use that science to intervene and to change the opportunities for so many kids. What the science shows us is just as we can activate each other's stress response, right?
Mm-hmm.
Biologically, as humans, we have the opportunity to buffer each other's stress response. What we see in the research is that when we do early detection and early intervention, we can profoundly change outcomes for kids.
So what does this look like in a classroom? Because I think about the kids who are quote unquote misbehaving. How many of them would you guess are suffering from at least one ACE or more?
You know, the research tells us that it's at least half of the kids. Right now, roughly 34 million children in the United States have experienced at least one adverse childhood experience. But what is so important about this science is that up until now, and frankly, it's still going on, right? Mm-hmm. That we're misdiagnosing the problem. A lot of folks are seeing kids who are having difficulty with impulse control, difficulty with self-regulation, who may be quick to anger. The only thing that they have in their toolkit is it must be ADHD, right? Mm-hmm. It must be attention deficit. And the treatment for attention deficit is stimulants. Because if you have an underactive attentive function and you give a stimulant, that actually should improve attention and cognitive ability. But the problem with that is that if the reason for all of these symptoms is an overactive stress response.
Yeah, you're on high alert, basically, right?
Exactly. Then stimulants may not actually be helpful. In that case, the treatment is different. The treatment is reducing the dose of adversity and enhancing the ability of all of the adults in that child's environment to be a buffer to that child's stress.
So the challenge is to change the mindset in the adults then, to not look at the kids as if they're a problem, but to ask, what happened to you instead?
Amen to that. I will say it's training adults to be able to recognize symptoms of toxic stress, to be able to understand how they can be part of the solution for kids.
What would that look like? How do you buffer a kid's environment so that they're not stressed out?
Step one for that is raising awareness, letting folks know and understand that this is even a problem to begin with, and that the root cause for many kids is an overactive stress response. The next step is something that I am so passionate about, which is routine screening for every child in their pediatrician's office.
Mm.
Right now, only 4% of pediatricians across the country are screening for adverse childhood experiences, and that needs to change. It needs to be everyone.
Mm.
And the next step is when we do identify, right, putting into place these systems that allow us to reduce the dose of adversity for kids and do this buffering work, right? There are so many folks who say, oh, it feels so overwhelming, that takes so many resources. I'm not going to say that it's not challenging, but right now we're misallocating a lot of our resources. We don't have alignment within our systems because I hear from doctors, from educators, from social workers, the problem's too big. I can't take it all on. And it's like, you don't have to take it all on. Let doctors do our part. We'll screen, mm. right? We'll do the early detection, the multidisciplinary response. And then for educators, you guys work on trauma-sensitive and trauma-responsive educational environments. You guys work on training every person in a child's educational environment, from the bus driver to the teacher to the principal to every person, to recognize what these symptoms are and to learn how they can help kids. Whether it's as simple as, You know, when a child is activated, giving them 20 minutes to be able to sit down and literally to let the levels of adrenaline in their bodies go down, right? So that way kids can start re-engaging their prefrontal cortex and de-escalating the activation of their amygdala.
Yeah, like their lid is flipped. Like you can't talk to somebody whose lid is flipped.
That's exactly right. And understanding how do we put these systems into place. I'll tell you one thing that I will be a happy woman the day that I see it is rather than expecting educators to both be educators and somehow be doctors and somehow be social workers and somehow be psychiatrists, it's like if you had 30 kids in a class and 15 of them had epilepsy or 15 of them had dyslexia, you would not have a teacher being like, oh, and by the way, how are your test scores? You would say, you know what? We need to make sure that we have the right plans in place, the right connections between the healthcare system and the educational system to make sure that these kids are getting the right support. But right now, because we think it's a behavioral problem and teachers are supposed to know how to deal with a behavioral problem, right? You are left with educators who feel like they're fighting an uphill battle and oftentimes it feels hopeless and it's not.
Yeah, they're totally overwhelmed. And, and full disclosure here, my son is adopted and he had multiple homes before he was even 11 months old. He was in three different foster homes plus being separated from his birth mom. I knew something was not quite right. And then someone told me about adverse childhood experiences and the symptoms of it. And I'm like, whoa, that's my son. And so trying to understand it is exactly what you're talking about and how to tell the adults what's going on and give him a way that he can de-escalate. But getting people on board is hard because there's so many judgmental people out there.
Yeah, you know, it's challenging. I think the biggest obstacle that we have is myth and misinformation. And that is why it was so important for me to write The Deepest Well and get the science out there, because we have this concept that, oh, well, these people just choose this behavior, or it's really an issue of bad parenting, right? Or, you know, whatever it is, we have all of these myths. A lot of that is an obstacle for us to address the underlying problem.
And if you are somebody who grew up with adverse childhood experiences, what can you do for yourself to somehow mitigate the health effects of what's happening?
There's so much that we can do. And folks ask me, you know, when is it too late? And I want to say that it's never too late. It's really important that people understand that. One of the first and most important things that we can do is just recognize if we ourselves have an overactive stress response. Understand that, hey, this is what our bodies are designed to do to protect us, but, you know, it's a little overactive. And so I have to understand, like, when is this on point and when is this not helping me anymore? One of the most important things that I say to my teenagers when I work with them is because of what you've experienced, your body might be making more stress hormones than the average person. And that can look and feel like being quick to anger or having trouble controlling your impulses or getting sick easily when you feel overwhelmed. I'll tell you what my teenagers say. They say, oh, you mean I'm not crazy? So getting rid of that self-judgment and that self-blame, just cut yourself a break, right? Yeah. Say, hey, body, thanks for trying to protect me. And then doing the things that are associated with helping us to regulate a stress response, right?
So mindfulness, for example?
Mindfulness. Oh, my goodness. So meditation is an important and powerful tool. The stress response, the fight or flight response, is our sympathetic nervous system. And it's directly counteracted by something called the parasympathetic nervous system, which is for resting and digesting. Meditation activates the parasympathetic nervous system, and it strengthens our ability to re-regulate this stress response. This is like biologically, like neurochemically, so important as a healing intervention. Things like regular exercise, you know, getting an hour a day of some type of physical activity or having good sleep hygiene. Like when we sleep, our stress response recalibrates itself. Poor sleep. It feels stressful. It is. But it's also because we are losing this process of decreasing our stress hormones and regulating our stress hormones while we're sleeping. So once we understand the underlying science, then we can use that to target interventions that specifically reduce stress hormones, reduce inflammation, and enhance neuroplasticity.
So if you could design a perfect day, would you start off by some vigorous exercise, go for a run or whatever it is you like to do to exercise, and then like meditate right after that? and then go on with your day?
You know, it's so funny. I actually, in my regular daily life, I wake up in the morning and I do my meditation first, and then I go for my walk.
Okay.
Yes, but that's just me. That's the order I do it.
Okay, so
yes.
It can work in the other direction.
Yes, exactly.
Has this research changed the way that you parent your own kids?
Yes. Heck yeah, that's what I was going to say. My husband and I have four boys.
Wow.
As a parent of adopted kids, ourselves, our two older boys are adopted. Mm. It has profoundly affected the way that I parent actually all of my kids, because number one, it helps me understand moments when, you know, our kids are a handful.
Yes.
And it's so important for me to say, you know what? This is not my kid trying to drive me crazy. This is not them like going off on me. Like, let me just, my job here is just to help them re-regulate, right? One of the most important things has been for me to bring home the importance of self-care for me as a parent. Oftentimes as parents, we kind of put ourselves last, and understanding that, wait a minute, I need to have my own stuff in check for me to be available to be that buffer for my child.
Right. Yeah. If your child is going off on you for whatever reason,
yes, exactly,
knowing that it's not about you, you know, yeah, and just kind of letting it wash over yourself like water over a duck.
Yeah.
You know,
that's, exactly.
It's easy to do in theory, but it's hard to do in practice.
Yeah. And the other thing about it also is also recognize that there are moments as a parent where I don't got it. Mm-hmm. Right? There are moments where I myself am overwhelmed for whatever reason. And in those moments, I don't try to white knuckle through it anymore. Right? It's like, call the village. If you got a girlfriend, if you have a sibling, if there's a grandparent out there, if it's even like a trusted neighbor or something like that, someone who can really be there for you in the moments where you're not able to be there in the way that you want to be there for your kids. The most important thing is that your child is getting that safe, stable, nurturing relationship, and that you are getting the care that you need for yourself.
Dr. Nadine Burke Harris's new book is The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. Follow her at Dr. Burke Harris. Dr. Burke Harris, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.